Hey, this is Damien O'Doherty with the Lobby Podcast here on Center Maryland. We are so fortunate to have Gene Ransom. He is in charge of MedCAI, which is the state's Medical and Neurological Society. Did I get that right?
Gene? You did. That was good. That was good.
It was close. So that means that Gene is in charge of the representation of all the doctors in the state of Maryland. Gene, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to me. Let's get the business right out of the way so I can have a little fun with you. You are you're an omnipresent figure in Maryland politics, and you've done actual local government like me, but you have a professional career. It's representing the doctors. This has to be the most poignant session you've ever been in.
Yeah, it's been really frustrating. COVID has taught us a lot. And this session we're dealing with, to the best of our ability in this new Zoom world that we're in, we're dealing with the issues around COVID, you know, issues like telemedicine and what tour protections are going to be in place and how does the vaccine work? I mean, we're dealing with issues like that this session, which is making it a little different.
What are your big priorities? I mean, you're the most organized advocate in Annapolis. You find your way into every conversation that's relevant to your constituency. Talk to me.
Yeah, I think our biggest priorities, if you were rattling them down, is number one, making sure Medicaid gets funded appropriately. That's really important to us. COVID has shined a light on disparities, and we want to make sure that people who don't have the means have access to healthcare, and that's a big deal. The second biggest priority, I'd say, is telehealth. Telehealth's become huge during this whole pandemic, and we need to make sure that some of the things that have been created during the crisis stay in place and stay in place appropriately with the right checks and balances and protections. And then also the tort issue. If we can't work through tort in a time when everybody sees the value of healthcare workers, then will we ever be able to?
Yeah, you know, look, I come from a family of trial lawyers, as you know, doctors and trial lawyers. So Thanksgiving was really something special in my household. And, you know, you see the doctors putting their lives at risk. You see them putting their practices on the line. And then you walk outside of the health facility and you see a giant trial lawyer ad on a billboard strategically placed to try to find any opportunity to cash in.
And you know, you and I are both University of Baltimore Law School grads. We both are alumni and proud of that. And we have a lot of friends who make money suing folks. And I guess it's one of those things as an attorney, I can look at it and go, you know what, when someone has a wrong, they should be aggrieved, and that's fair. But what we don't want is a lottery style system. And that's what we're seeing in places. When you see people running ads about ventilator selection before there was even a ventilator taken away from anybody, it's troubling. And I think what we need to do is to have a real discussion about what is the appropriate immunities and protections that are necessary in a pandemic and an emergency. And that's the discussion we're trying to have in Annapolis. And we're not having it with a lot of success, frankly. It's been a really hard issue for us this session. And I think it's been hard. We're trying to figure out what needs to be done and how do we make it so we have a system that works when there is a crisis.
We had the highest court in the land, or was it the Court of Special Appeals that ruled in favor of Hopkins?
It was the Court of Special Appeals. So, you know, obviously, and they've requested certiorari. So the highest court in Maryland is the Court of Appeals, and I'm sure we'll have another hearing on that. For the people who are listening who don't know about that, this is the Bayview case where there was close to just under a quarter billion dollar judgment against Hopkins in a malpractice case. And there were all kinds of issues with it. MedCAI actually filed an amicus brief in that case on the side of Johns Hopkins. So we were very excited with the outcome. In fact, some of the language in the amicus brief that MedCAI and the AMA filed together was picked up in the Court of Special Appeals opinion.
Who was your lawyer? Were you able to give your lawyer a little shout out at this time for that?
we worked with the AMA Litigation Center and used national counsel. So So I don't recall exactly who we ended up using. So I'm not able to, unfortunately.
You just know it wasn't on your dime. So that's a good thing.
It was a group effort. And we do actually pay into the litigation fund. So we did have a little skin in the game because this issue was really important to us from a fairness point of view.
So everybody's talking about frontline workers. Everybody's talking about, protecting our nurses and doctors. The whole legislature's focused on COVID. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to liability, they're saying, we don't need to deal with this just yet. Is that right?
And that's what we're hearing. That's what we're hearing clearly. It's very frustrating from a membership point of view. We think if we can't get it done now, when are we going to be able to get it done? And that's what we're hearing in Annapolis, unfortunately. We're pushing hard and we're talking to people and doing what we need to do. But, I run the whole society. So we have lots of business lines and things we do, but my heart is with the advocacy. You know, that's what the members want. And you can tell when things aren't going 100% your way. And this is not 100% going your way. So I'm just being truthful about it. And it's frustrating because, like I said, if there's a time when we could figure this out or that there would be a desire to figure it out, I would hope it would be now. But I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do on this front. We've got to figure out some way to change this system.
We know what we're going to do. Apparently, it sounds like we're just going to wait for some abominable crisis to occur and have some terrible set of outcomes from poor policy that affect real people. And then there'll be a crisis legislative session, right? Is that the only way you can?
I worked for MedKai as a young lawyer. Actually, I've worked for MedKai since 1996. I'm in my 25th year. And I worked for MedKai as a young lawyer when we had our last crisis in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I know what it was like, where malpractice rates were going through the roof and doctors were going bare, which is a horrible result for patients. And it was a complete disaster. And we had rallies where thousands of physicians and nurses were heading down to the Capitol. And then we ended up passing reform. It would seem to me, though, we should all be smarter and we should take a deep breath and see if we can't find a better place and a better system. And I think there are problems, too, where because of the system we have people who have harms where they can't be corrected or taken care of who are getting hurt as well. I think this just calls for some smart discussion. And while we're not doing as well on tort, we are doing better. The Medicaid budget looks like right now it's going to be properly funded. And on telehealth, I feel the General Assembly is taking that one seriously. So I guess 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And baseball, that would be incredible, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've got your hands full there. And telehealth is one of these issues, again, where everybody just, they knew it was something they were going to have to deal with, but it looked like a blip on the horizon. You know, now the mast is right over their head. And you all are doing an incredible job trying to educate legislators about the benefits of telehealth. And it's got to have a special meaning when these docs sometimes can't even get into their offices to practice. It's gotta have some real urgency.
No, it's interesting from helping doctors through this crisis, which is something MedKai has been right in the center of. We have physicians who've been so busy because they're working on people related to the pandemic, but then we've got a lot of physicians who are in financial crisis because they can't do elective procedures. They can't see as many patients. So it's kind of a tale of two cities within the world that we're living in. With regards to telehealth, it has been a lifesaver. It's been a lifesaver for patients. It's been a lifesaver for physicians. The key is, though, is that we're working under a bunch of executive orders that allow us to do these things because we really don't have the rules in place. And we've got to get that framework in place where there are checks and balances. We want to make sure that crazy things don't happen, you know, where somebody's providing telehealth and it's a total sham of some kind. But we also need to make sure that the infrastructure that's been created as a result of those executive orders, like paying for audio calls, like paying for telehealth visits, parity for telehealth visits, that stays in place. I will say this, the General Assembly has taken this task very seriously. They're doing a lot of work on it. There's a proposal from the administration we have some concerns with, but you know they're working on the issue, which is important. And then there's a proposal from Delegate Pena Melnick, which is the one that there seems to be a lot more work on, and we're very excited about. I think we're going to see something done this session on it.
you guys aren't just hustling on the legislative front. You guys joined the 5G partnership and really trying to close the gap on the digital divide.
Yeah, that's a big issue for just, it's, you might not think, oh, MedKai, why are we involved in the 5G partnership? Well, we signed onto that again because of this telehealth issue. So what we're finding is, and particularly in rural areas, but not just in rural areas, actually some of the poorer parts of the urban areas that we're in, there just is not access to the infrastructure so patients can take advantage of the products. And ironically, in the places where we need the access the most, we have the worst infrastructure. So I guess that's the way everything works.
Social determinants of health, right? I mean,
And disparities. I mean, COVID has shined a light on the disparities, whether it be disparities with broadband, disparities with access to healthcare, disparities with regards to who gets the disease. It has just shined a light on this inequity that is in our culture that we need to work on. And that, it might be funny for me to say that, but in a strange way, I think that might even be a positive, because now I think people are going to have to deal with this problem and they're going to have to solve it. And I think that the fact that we have seen such disparities so highlighted by this crisis will result in policymakers doing something about it, which I think in a strange way might be a positive in the long run.
Vaccines, your people have been at the front lines of that. You know, everybody wants to beat up the drug companies until you're like me and you got a kid that needs medicine to survive from childhood leukemia, or you like to jam up the pharmaceutical companies until we got to come up with a with a vaccine for a pandemic. What's your take on the vaccine situation?
And I got to say too, I mean, it just shows you how incredible our system is for all of its flaws. You know, pharma got the stuff done and they got it produced. And a lot of that work was done right here in Maryland. You know, University of Maryland was doing clinical trials on this and continues to do clinical trials. Hopkins has been involved in some of these tests. And then we have the Johnson & Johnson is actually being produced in Maryland. So when you think about how incredible it is that in 1919, there wasn't a vaccine. We just essentially herd immunity did and had a lot of people die. It's incredible where we are today and what the system can produce. I think the other thing with the vaccine that we have to worry about is that there are a lot of people who are nervous about it and they don't want to take it. And science is real and vaccines work. You should take vaccines. And I think this is an issue actually that we agree with pharma on, because the science shows it. And this is an issue not just for COVID, it's an issue for all kinds of other diseases and issues where we need to make sure that people get the vaccines they need.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue trying to, I mean, I try to have empathy for the people that are nervous about the taking the vaccine and just imagine them like me, you know, 14 hours a day right into this device. And for whatever reason, their device is loading up information that makes them feel uneasy about vaccines, or maybe it's been a cultural experience in many cases, or the just sheer politicization of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think folks in your industry, in your profession, have been extraordinary in trying to break through that. But it's a tough barrier to overcome.
One of the things that I think is going to be really important is, as we get more vaccine coming into the state, is getting those physicians' office vaccinating. Now, we've been working closely with the Hogan administration. We have over 350 practices signed up and pre-approved to get vaccines, so that's going to happen. But I think when your physician is saying, yes, it's safe, I've taken it, and I'm going to give it to you, that'll give you a higher level of comfort than just, you know, going to a mass vaccination site or being told by a politician. So I do think we are going to be part of the solution here in the long run. And look, I think everybody should get it as soon as they're eligible to get it. And it's going to be the way we get out of this thing and get back to normalcy, which I think we're all ready for.
Well, speaking of normalcy, folks listening can't see behind you, but you behind you is like a rate the room experience here. I'd love for you to look behind yourself and look what's there behind you, and just give me a little story about what you got
there. All right, so I'm in my home office. One of the benefits of the pandemic is that I get to work from home a lot more. And
where's home?
home is on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. I am a lifelong resident of Queen Anne's County. I grew up there. And in fact, over my shoulder here is a picture of my second term in the Queen Anne's County Commission. I'm a twice elected Queen Anne's County Commissioner. I didn't run for re-election, and I'm the last Democrat elected in Queen Anne's County. We haven't had one since me. So I'm a dying breed. There's a picture of me when I was an intern for Delegate Ken Montague up there.
Oh,
Ken,
wow.
And I was on the front page of the Baltimore Sun back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, was that when, that was before the big Larry Young trial. He played sort of a monumental role in the Larry Young experience. That was my first day in Maryland politics. I was putting the nameplates out for the Baltimore City delegation, and I remember putting Senator Larry Young's nameplate right out there for the city delegation, and actually ended up, he never came after that, ended up giving that nameplate to Senator Michael Collins, who was the ethics co-chair with Ken Montague, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, Collins was the senator. Right. And Ken was the House chair. So they were
co-chair. Ken Montague had a great reputation. A
wonderful, wonderful man. I worked for him in the mid-90s. It was one of the first politicians I worked for, and it was a wonderful thing to, he was a great model to learn from. I've got, of course, pictures of the kids. Got a picture there of Louis Goldstein. So I was president of the Young Democrats of Maryland in 96. And when I took over, they were a little in the hole financially. We were a little broke. So Louis agreed and did a fundraiser at his house. And in that picture is a picture of me and Louis and Paul Wellstone. If for those of you who remember, Louis's daughter worked for Paul Wellstone. So Louis got his daughter to get Paul to come over for a fundraiser at his house to get us out of the hole.
You ever share those? I think Brooke Learman has some Paul Wellstone connections. You ever share any stories with her?
Yeah, I have ties. Actually, I'm really close. Now getting back into more of my past, I was on the executive board of the Democratic Party when Brooke's father, Terry, was the chair.
Right.
He did a great job. So, yeah, I've had some conversations that the Learman family's got all kinds of connections. There's no question about that. So, yeah, so it's kind of funny because I've worked for MedKai for so long, and so many people think of me as MedKai and the physician face. I had this other life. Back when I was a young lawyer for the Medical Society, where I was really involved in Democratic politics. I was, like I said, I was elected as a county commissioner for two terms. I was president of Young Democrats. I did 4 years on the Democratic Central Committee in Queen Anne's County before I was elected as a commissioner. And I was just really an activist. I even got to be, you can't see it on this wall behind me, but I also got to be an elector for Barack Obama. I voted for him for real in 2008. So I really enjoyed that time being involved in politics and working on it. And unfortunately, as head of MedKai, I spent a lot of time, we have about 70 or so employees. We run a rehab center and an insurance agency. We have all these businesses and services. And I spent a large amount of my time really working on running the operations as a CEO. I don't get to spend as much time on the politics and the advocacy as I'd like. I really enjoy it. And I really enjoy my time in Annapolis because I feel like a lot of stuff you can work on either through politics or through policy can really make the world a better place. I really do believe that, and that's what I enjoy. And that's the thing I love the most about my job is when we get to work on things like making Medicaid work better or making telehealth work better, or how do we change health policy so people actually have more access to care. That's my passion, at MedKai.
Do you feel a sense of loss, or do you miss being in local government? Do you ever think about maybe I should, things are so messed up these days, somebody as valuable as me should get back into the public life?
I believe in public service. In fact, I'm on my local liquor board. So that's kind of my role in local public service.
That's real work.
Work. You don't even want to know. If you think healthcare is complicated, you should go talk about liquor law.
I remember Tom Minkin, who's, Pete Angelos' right-hand man. He was our liquor license chair in Baltimore County. And he would just, at the end of his term, he just said, not one article. We didn't get one article about us. Like that was his whole role,
Well, that he was really good if he managed to do that. But I guess my point is, so I think public service is not always being elected, that it's being involved. It's volunteering. I'm an assistant scout master in my son's troop. It's being involved in your community. And that's important. I think we all have that duty and that responsibility. And I think a lot of people who have a lot of value don't volunteer, and they should take a breath and think about it. with regards to being a local elected official, one of the beauties of being a county commissioner is every Tuesday night, I have a line of people telling me how stupid I was. And that was great. It was great training for life. You realize that you're flawed and you make a lot of mistakes. But the one thing I really loved about it was you could do something and it would be done and it would be yours. Or, you know, we built the emergency room in Queenstown, working collaboratively with the state and with the University of Maryland Medical System. We, when I was a county commissioner, we would redevelop areas and see it done. We built a beautiful school in Sellersville when the old school had literally holes in the gym wall and an electrical system from the 1930s. So, you know, when you do things like that and you complete projects, it feels really good.
And you can show your kids, right? Like that, I always liked about local government, you know, is that like, you know, we got this approved. We, you know, they said we'd never get this elementary school done, you know, and you can point to it and it sort of associates your children can associate your work with good deeds. If you're in Washington and sometimes Annapolis, it gets a little policy laden or it seems a little distant and tough to connect the work back, I think.
Yeah. My names are on some plaques in Queen Anne's County. There's no question about that. But it doesn't, I don't know. My name's also on some plaques with some things that maybe I don't want it on, you know? So it all works out. It all works out one way or the other. You try to do the best you can. You make some mistakes. You learn a lot from it. I don't know, though, that I would want to jump back in it. I do have a passion for public service. I think it's important, but I don't think it has to be as an elected official. It doesn't, it could be, but it doesn't have to be. So I've been at MedKind now. Like I told you, I'm starting my 25th year here and I think I can do some service here and it's been enjoyable and fun and I'm trying to make a difference in this job.
You really developed a cool quilt of action and activism, you know, in your own way that covers, you know, quite a bit of cold feet in your district and your state. Where does that drive come from?
I don't know. I don't know why. I think probably my parents who always felt, I know when I was growing up, we weren't the wealthiest and we didn't live in the best part of Queen Anne's County. But I do know every night we'd have dinner together and we'd talk about politics, talk about, you know, community. And I think it made a difference.
Let me ask you this, you know, you've seen me try to do this thing called the trail on LinkedIn and you've been very gracious.
I love that. I love
commenting on it. You know, one thing I think, you know, I think I went on the trail looking for my father, who at times was homeless, had schizophrenia, brilliant, wonderful human being, had a lot of challenges. And I always feel like I was sort of looking for him out on the trail. And you see Joe Biden, you got to imagine, you know, his journey is just about as much about Bo as it is about himself. You know, we all thought Bo would be the Biden that would be president one day. And we saw Carson Kamnitz, young guy for Center Maryland and my firm, you know, lost his dad and was able to see him out interviewing people. Was there anybody you were looking for on the trail or anything you were looking for?
No, I would say, look, I always love politics. I always love public service. I don't think it was an individual or anything. I did believe when I ran, particularly for county commissioner, that developers had too much control. And I wanted to take that back. And there was something magical about the Queen Anne's County I grew up in. You know, I grew up in a place where we could ride our bikes to Cabin Creek and go swimming, you know, and I grew up in a place where you knew each other when you went in the grocery store.
Right.
And I grew up in a place that was diverse. In fact, I showed a picture of me in second grade and the majority of my class was Black. Now, when you look at my son's second grade picture in the same elementary school, the majority of his class is white. And this gentrification, this undue control by developers was something that really bothered me. And I ran to try to do something about it. So it wasn't really an individual. It was really more a passion for what I knew and what I grew up in. And I really did believe that Queen Anne's County and that area was Eden. And I was afraid we were losing Eden, to steal from the book. You know, I just really believe that. And that was what I wanted to have happen. I don't know if I won or I lost. I don't know if we made a difference. We preserved a lot of land. We changed zoning. We did the best we could. I gave the good fight. And now I've decided I'm going to put that passion in trying to make healthcare work better. And the great thing about healthcare is when you're working on it, it's not partisan. No one's asking is your doctor a Republican or a Democrat? They're just saying, hey, can she fix me? You know, that's what they're worried about.
Well, look, you and I both get young kids or children of friends of ours who want to get into politics. And I say, you mean healthcare? And they said, want to get into advertising. I go, you mean healthcare? I want to get into lobbying. You mean healthcare? Like, to me, it's the plastics of the graduate today is healthcare. You know, it is the thing to be a part of, especially in this state.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's going to be a lot of innovation once we get through COVID as a result of the disruption that's occurred. And I think we're going to be looking at a lot of things differently. And Maryland's a great place to do it. We have the unique all-payer system. We have one of the best hospital infrastructures in the state. We've got a lot of science and innovation going on. There's a strong bio industry in certain parts of the state, like Montgomery County and in Baltimore with the University of Maryland and Hopkins. You could not have a better place in the country from a brain power and from an infrastructure point of view to do healthcare than Maryland.
Hey, while I got you here, we saw each other on a call the other day, State of Reform. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a conference that is essentially and it's going to be online this year, which is fantastic, and it'll be an interesting convening spot, but it's usually live, and it's a cool thing because they do it state by state, because that's where the action is in so much of healthcare. And then they bring together, you know, health policy leaders, they bring together advocates, activists, they put them all in one room or all in one call with breakouts. You excited about that? I saw you on the convening panel, one of the leaders putting it together.
Interestingly, I talked to my colleagues in some of the other states where they've done it already, and it's been a very productive, good thing. I think any forum where you can increase communication between the different parties in healthcare is positive.
Healthcare gets a little clicky in Maryland, and people have their expertise, and each click allows each other to have that expertise. So it'll be interesting to see them interacting together a little more.
And silos are created in healthcare. Yeah. And I think that's a big one. So if we can have a discussion, because I think a lot of what people are saying, you're going to find common threads or common themes. And can we use those common threads and common themes to break down silos and bring people together? I mean, that's the question. And anytime you create an atmosphere where the different groups can talk and listen to each other, there's a possibility that could happen.
It's the time to get people together, right? Any big lessons you want to share with, or let me ask you a little more pointed question. This will be the last one. Any people you are seeing in the lobby, or now the lobby's on your screen or in your phone, any people you're seeing out there in that Annapolis culture or the Washington, D.C. culture that is really making an impact on you as we're in this peculiar time, some people that are really standing out?
Well, I'll tell you what's really stood out is that during this crisis, during the whole crisis, I've had some legislators really make a point of reaching out and helping us out. And a lot of times when you run a large association, we have over 8,000 physicians. We are the ones calling. We're the ones proactively saying, will you help me with this? Will you help me with that? So I've had legislators like Josh and Pena Melnick, Senator Rosa Pep, Shane Pendergrass, Brian Feldman, others reaching out to us during this whole last year saying, what do you need? What are you hearing? Craig Zucker. So I think what I've really appreciated is the fact that the phone didn't just work one way, which oftentimes in politics, as you and I know, given our history, that could be the way it was. And I know I'm probably forgetting some of the folks who really reached out and helped or made suggestions. And one of the things I think that was particularly helpful was we were having some trouble early on as these funds flowed from the federal government, from the Trump administration. And people like Senator Rosa Pep, you know, calling and leaning on folks for us and saying, hey, can I help you? And remember, he's on the Budget and Tax Committee. So it's not even necessarily like he's in the health space. Reaching out and doing things like that was a big help.
He's an amazing dude. During the presidential campaign, he and my partner, Rick Abruzzi, were bringing in national leaders from the European Union into battleground states saying, hey, look, we just want to let you know what this Trump situation is like in Germany or what it feels like in another EU country. So, I mean, Rosapep is a totally active, engaged human being, right?
And like I said, I know I'm forgetting some people, but sure, they know who they are. I appreciated the reach outs. I appreciate, even if there was just a check and make sure, hey, what's going on with MedKai? You guys doing all right? Is everything all right? Did you keep? And I'm very proud of the fact that we kept all our employees on. Nobody lost 1 hour of anything, and we switched to telework, and everybody kept working because there, between all our entities and everything, there are 73 people who work for MedKai who work for us, and I want to make sure they're okay too. And I think that's important. And what I also saw during this whole thing is there were a lot of employers in Maryland who stepped up and did the right thing. I mean, I look at like a Kaiser Permanente, didn't lay off a single employee in Maryland, you know, just kept working. That's huge. So I you see these things, and I think that's one of the other things during this pandemic that I look at and I go, that was a big positive. So, you know, I'm like you said, healthcare. It's the graduate. It's the thing. So I think this is a great space to be working in. It'll be very different. I don't know that it'll be what it looks like today, but it is going to be the issue. And America has a lot of work to do in this space. And I think that work has just been highlighted by the COVID crisis. It's showing that we've got to figure out, you know, we can't rely on foreign countries for PPE anymore. You know, we've got to treat healthcare as something that is a national security issue. We need to be able to produce vaccines, to produce personal injury protective equipment. We need to be able to do these things here. We need to have policies that make sense. We need to make sure that everybody has access to care. We need to make sure that disparities are addressed and talked about and corrected, and the systemic issues that create those disparities are addressed and corrected. So we have a lot of work to do. So we need all those smart people to not go run for office. They need to go work in healthcare.
Hey, last question. Hey, I'm just going to steal your thought leadership here for a moment if I can. And it's a little off the cuff, but the future of what healthcare looks like to a consumer is of interest to me. You know, we've seen sort of the Greenspring station model in Baltimore County at I-83 and 695. It was one of the first places to kind of combine retail, little office, and medical office. And it was amazing for my family. You know, my wife could go and take care of the kid and get some shopping done. You know, it was a very accessible place for me. We see down in National Harbor, amazing University of Maryland medical system engagement down there. You see Inova coming across the harbor. And so there's this new kind of hub there at National Harbor, thanks to the Peterson companies. I've been working with Howard Hughes Corporation in downtown Columbia. We promised at Meriwether that we were going to have a cyber hub. And lo and behold, we've got the biggest cyber company in 2018, Tenable, biggest IPO. Their headquarters is going to be there, all kinds of spinoff. Now we're looking at the lakefront over by the Whole Foods and where Clyde's used to be. And we're trying to make that a health hub. We've talked to some health systems. We've talked to a number of different physician practices. Any tips for us as I know you love developers, but this is an interesting.
No, okay, but that's actually, there's a difference. So that's good development. So,
well, yeah, it's already approved. The community.
On top of that, though, there's a difference between taking farm fields and turning them into track homes and taking an area like Columbia that's planned and logical and is a town center and building that out. That's what we should be doing. That's called smart growth. Right. We can have a longer conversation about that. But
how could we figure out from the docs sort of what's important to them? You know, what's a health hub mean to docs?
So I think though that this is a really good model for the way healthcare is going. And I don't want to take us too far backwards, but so Maryland obviously has this unique waiver where the hospitals are on global budgets. And there's been a push generally across the country to go to population health and to move things out of high cost areas. So taking that idea, this push towards value-based medicine, you know, value over volume, having these centers where people can get their population health needs met and then they can have other things that they do makes a lot of sense to me. I think that's a logical thing. I think the Greenspring stations are the future because hospitals have an incentive to do more care outside of their hospitals based on the way the model's set up. So
yeah, I mean, we've got like,
makes a lot of sense to me.
We've got like 100 miles of trails that connect right to that. We've got, you know, all the social determinants of health sort of there in a very positive culture out there. So
I think the key is, though, can you get a couple anchors in those types of developments? Can you get a strong primary care anchor, you know, who's going to bring people there for their primary care visits? Can you get an ambulatory surgery center there, which would then allow people to get minor procedures done, you know, in and out type procedures, things that they could be done in a hospital, but are probably better set in an outside patient setting? And I think that could make a lot of sense from an economic development point of view, from actually a development point of view, because having those things in an urban area around a lot of people is logical. It kind of fits everything. So I think it makes a lot of sense. So I think you guys are on track with what you're doing. In fact, if you look, it's not the only place it's happening. I think the University of Maryland is making a really nice investment in partnership down in Cambridge.
That's right.
With the new development there. And that's a pretty cool, that's going to be kind of a health hub type, you know, outside setting. It's going to redevelop a large part of Dorchester County. So that when we're all heading to Ocean City in the summer, I think some people are going to start to be able to see some of that work where they're whipping down 50.
Well, you might need to give us a tour.
Yes, Larry. That's a little south of me, but I can certainly do that. I'm pretty well versed with the entire shore, haven't been a lifer over here. But my point is that I think this is the new, I think this is the future, that it's going to have to fit in. It's going to be more outpatient. And I think the hospitals recognize that. If you look, MedStar recently announced the purchase of Right Time, which is a very large urgent care center. And MedStar has been building out a lot of their hubs. Kaiser Permanente is in the middle of building a beautiful new facility in Timonium. So you see that there's this movement to these outpatient centers. So I think it fits in and it makes a lot of sense. The key is too, is you want to have a partnership with a hospital with part of that too. So there's a logical relationship back and forth and it fits in with them. And hopefully you guys have been working with and talking to Howard General there, which is part of the Hopkins system, because you couldn't have a better partner than Johns Hopkins.
I've lived it, man. They're fantastic people there. Any last words? You are you're one of the finest advocates we know. Any last plugs for our world-class doctors in Maryland?
No, I think the thing I just want to say is I want to thank all the doctors. I've worked now with physicians, like I said, for 25 years. I'm very blessed. It's odd that I'd walk into a grant position right out of law school and end up staying there in one capacity or another for as long as I have had. And they've let me do so many other things while I've been there. But I just really appreciate these physicians who have done so much. And all healthcare workers and all essential workers.
Because if you're in that world as a physician, as a nurse, you can pick up any job in the world. You could literally be doing anything, and they're choosing to do these professions where they literally have to put the practice on the side for a year, and then they have to go and risk their lives.
Right. And remember, these are people. Being a doctor isn't the deal it used to be. You know, it used to be you were going to be one of the wealthier people. Now it's a middle class job. It's not the same deal it was. A lot of really smart people go run a hedge fund. You know, you don't go do brain surgery. So I just appreciate it, working with them. I appreciate everything they do. I appreciate the difference they make in all our lives. And I'm very proud to be working for them and representing them. And I think I'm an optimist about the General Assembly. I think these guys are going to, I think they're going to work out something. We're going to get Medicaid properly funded. We're going to get telehealth legislation passed that makes sense. Maybe the tort stuff is too hard for them to do, but if we get 2 out of 3 again, I'll take that and we'll move on to fight another day and we'll try to solve another problem.
The Maryland General Assembly, somehow it's like 10 years younger than it was last cycle and seems like even smarter. So younger and smarter. It's exciting.
And about ready to have redistricting in a really weird way. So it's going to change again. So don't get too used to all those people. I keep telling folks, I'm like, you know, Baltimore City is going to lose at least a senator and a half. The math just doesn't work with the population. If somehow Hogan gets his dream of single member delegate districts, you could have an amazing turnover in the House of Delegates. I don't think the General Assembly is going to let that happen. But my point is, no matter what happens, you're going to have a lot of people change their seats. So we've already had a lot of organic turnover that's occurred. It's going to be exacerbated. And I think this announcement by the census that it's coming out later means that it could be crazy what happens. That's the thing politically I'm kind of watching out of the corner of my eye. What does that mean? On top of the fact that everybody and their brother will be running for governor or lieutenant governor or this or that too. You'll have people moving around for congressional seats. I think we're about ready to have a real shift in the politics in Maryland.
Well, it would be less than coincidental or more than coincidental if all of that happened after Thomas V. Mike Miller passed, because he was the person that sort of kept the eye on the ball of those very important, intricate, nuanceical experiences that are key to democratic control in the state of Maryland.
Well, I wouldn't underestimate the Bill Ferguson.
And well, I've already underestimated him three times, and he's proven me wrong every time. So yeah, Melanie
Griffith, Bill Ferguson, Guy Gazan, people like that are keeping their eye on this. So I think they'll do. But the issue is that no matter how much control, and even Mike Miller, when he would go through redistricting, would do this. Change has to occur. It's just the nature of the population shift. So it's going to happen, and I just think that's the thing politically. We are going to have a really good idea after next session. Probably we'll know 10 or 15 people who the likelihood of them coming back is not high. Right. And then there's probably another 30 that are going to be in very risky situations. But I think you're going to have senators with senators, delegates with delegates, people in districts that don't look demographically like they do, which makes it very challenging for them to win. So we're about ready to have a major change in Maryland politics. And I think
you'll be the biggest insight of the pod there today. Very good. No,
I think that's the thing I'm kind of keeping the corner of my eye on and paying attention to. It's really important. And I do wonder, we'll see, this will be a big test of the Jones Ferguson era. How are they going? This is their first major political challenge. How do they manage this? Because it'll make all the difference in the world. And having been very close to Senator Miller, who was a wonderful friend of mine and helped, he raised money for me when I first ran for county commissioner, actually. He came over across the
bridge. How to pick a winner?
Yeah, I guess. Anyway, but he's even
better at picking losers. Like he when he bets against you, somehow he's got money on the losers. So.
Yeah, it's impressive. But he was a master at these things. You're right. So it'll be interesting to see how these guys do. But I think they're going to surprise everybody. I think we're in for an interesting outcome. We'll see how it all rolls, but
I think you're right.
You're
right. Well, you know, everybody was questioning Senator Ferguson on the combining University of Maryland with University of Maryland at Baltimore, and that's already delivering huge results. He's he has a very special demeanor and approachability, I think, that you didn't have with the former Senate president. And I think Speaker Jones, I've been watching her since I worked for County Executive Jim Smith, and she's just a stalwart. Like she's there all the time. You know, she may not be your biggest advocate at a certain time or your biggest enemy, but she is always in the room where it happens. And you can't, she's just,
people
it is where it is.
People have been underestimating Bill Ferguson for 20 years. I mean, right. Thought he wasn't going to beat Senator Della, and he didn't just beat him.
I was one of those guys. I told him, I said, your mail's not even going to get delivered.
So
my partner, Steve Carney, helped him out because he helped him out with the Sun endorsement. So we take a little credit for that, but it's long washed ashore.
I mean, if you look at it, it's meteoric for politics to rise as quickly as he has. But he hasn't even really been in elected office for 20 years, and he's already president of the Senate. It just makes you wonder where the end is with him.
He's going to be in the game.
He's
a talented guy.
I've been impressed with him since the first time I met him. So, and that South Baltimore district, man, they bring some winners.
It's the most powerful district in the state.
If you think about right now, and it could be even more with Learman running for comptroller, and you got Luke as chair of the Judiciary Committee. And I mean, but there's a long history of that district kind of having some important people come from there. Very interesting. So
two Senate presidents in the modern era.
Yes.
Hey, listen, we all love your professional approach to things. We admire your fastidiousness and your ability to stay connected through generations of elected officials. But I think most of all, we admire your affability and your connectiveness, and just can't thank you enough for being that kind of person. It makes our profession more special.
Well, thank you. You're too kind, and looking forward to doing this again with you.
All right. Thanks so much. He's Gene Ransom. He represents all the doctors in the state of Maryland. So grateful to have you.